Well, I must say, after hearing an introduction like that, I have to remind myself that it's me that's being talked about. I thought I might start very briefly just to give you some small details, a few details about how the Human Rights Branch and the Human Rights Commission are set up here in this province. The first Human Rights Act was passed in 1969. There is similar legislation in virtually every province across Canada as of this date. The Human Rights Commission really came into existence just about a year ago. Their role is to act as independent citizens. They're not employees of the government. They are a five-member group of people. The chairperson is Bishop Raimi DeRue of Victoria, and the four other members have been active in civil rights, in native rights, in women's issues, and in labor matters. They are independent. Their role is to set policy and to be in contact with public feeling on issues of discrimination. I am not one of the Human Rights Commission members. I am director of the Human Rights Branch. That means that I am a public employee. I work in the Department of Labor. We have four human rights officers in the province. We are responsible for enforcing the legislation. That means that we receive the complaints of discrimination. We investigate them to find out if they are substantiated or not, and then we attempt to conciliate or settle them if possible. If we can't, then we may refer the case to the Minister of Labour, who can set up a board of inquiry, which is a semi-judicial body which has the power to order what shall be done in that particular case. So that is just a very brief outline of how, in practice, human rights legislation is administered in this province. Human rights legislation is based on the premise that all are born free and equal in dignity and rights. It upholds and defends the principle of equal opportunity for all, regardless of race, religion, color, ancestry, sex, or marital status. It maintains that each individual is entitled to the opportunity to achieve according to their individual ability and wishes. The very fact that it has been necessary for human rights legislation to come into existence across Canada is recognition of the need for special protection for particular groups of people. It is a recognition of group inequality, recognition of social injustice, denial of opportunity, simply by virtue of belonging to a certain group. In its most basic form, what in fact is discrimination? What forms does it take? How is it dealt with under human rights legislation? Discrimination under human rights laws can be defined as differential treatment. Human rights legislation requires that the same treatment be accorded without distinction, regardless of the race, color, ancestry, religion, sex, or marital status of the person in question. Whatever the requirements, the standards, or the norms may be, they must be applied equally. Now, what kinds of practical situations does the Act cover? It deals with the most basic areas of public interaction which involve the very necessities for survival. To sum it up, it deals with employment, it deals with housing, and it deals with public services and facilities. I'll give you a few examples of the kinds of cases, the kind of complaints that we receive. One example we received last year dealt with a Native Indian who arrived at a motel in the northern part of the province. He drove up, parked, went to the registry desk, and asked for a room for that night. He was told that there were no rooms available, that a hockey team had checked in earlier, and all the rooms were taken. He went out straight to his car where his wife was waiting for him. His wife was white, so he asked her to go in to the desk. She went straight in, asked for a room for the night, was immediately given a room. This is discrimination as defined by the Human Rights Act. This is a contravention that we can deal with. A second example that we are presently in the process of dealing with. An employment agency in Vancouver places people in positions dealing mostly with technological and mechanical skills. A man phoned up, was asked questions on the phone about his qualifications. His qualifications, his experience were first rate. They were extremely delighted that he was interested. They could place him in a job immediately. It then came out that he had originally come from the West Indies. There was a long pause on the telephone, and then the question was asked, "Are you black?" The answer was yes. There was immediately a refusal to give him the job because the company in question would not accept black people. A third example involved a municipality in this area last year where a woman applied for a job and the work was out clearing a trail. She was refused the job and was told that they would not hire women for this kind of work. One of the reasons given, which is a very common one, which seemed somewhat incredulous in this situation, was the lack of public facilities, of toilets, of female washrooms, and the fact that in this job, the facility was the nearest tree. We found it difficult to try and understand in what way female toilet facilities were lacking for this work situation. Perhaps you need a special kind of tree, I don't know, but this was the argument that very seriously was given to our human rights officer by the lawyer for the municipality. This is a situation where we come in, we investigate, we can get the facts. In a case like this where it was clearly provable, we require that the person be hired if they still want the job and perhaps be compensated for the salary that they have lost because of the discrimination. Another example that we had last summer was a car rental agency on Vancouver Island where a group of Native Indians wanted to rent a car because they were participating in a sports tournament and they needed the car for the group of people to travel there. They were told no, the agency would not rent cars to Native Indians living on reserves. In all of these situations, these are clear-cut, direct, blatant discrimination. They are covered by the human rights legislation, and we can effectively deal with them and have the situation put right. What about other forms of discrimination? Very often, we find that in a complaint of discrimination, there was no intention to discriminate. But very often, the policy in question did result in discrimination. The effect of the policy was to discriminate against a racial group or against women. One example of this we might look at was when we were hiring human rights officers for the first time. And the requirement by the Public Service Commission, in their minds, a very valid requirement, was that people who wanted to apply for this job should have university degrees. And although when we wrote up the job description, we made it quite clear that we had nothing against people with university degrees, that we in no way regarded it as an essential qualification for the job, and we would accept and consider people with other forms of experience and qualifications. In the advertisement in the newspaper, because of the policy that was routinely followed, it came out that a degree was required for the job. And As I say, there was absolutely no intention to discriminate, but in actual effect, we know very well that here in British Columbia, if we look at the racial minorities, if we look at the situation of Native Indians, and we say, what impact does that policy have on Native Indian people? You can see right away by the handful of members of that group who have ever graduated from university that it would eliminate them from applying for that position. So that the effect of it would be to wipe out that whole group, regardless if they had tremendous ability to, in fact, do a splendid job. And at the same time, in Alberta, they were announcing with great gusto the appointment of the Lieutenant Governor, who was the first Native Indian to ever be appointed to that position. And in the newspapers, they were writing up the fact that he had no degrees, he had never even made it out of high school, but he had this fantastic array of achievements and ability that he had to his credit. And so that I thought this was a very good illustration that I could point out to the Public Service Commission that under their requirements, the Queen's representative, the highest representative in Alberta, the Lieutenant Governor, would not qualify even to put in an application for a human rights officer in the province of British Columbia. And this surely does not make sense, is not justifiable, and does, in effect, discriminate. There is a classic legal decision on this. Unfortunately, it is in the United States that this decision took place. And if I had time, I would comment on the fact, and perhaps there will be time later on, that legislation has been enforced and publicized, I think, more effectively in the United States on human rights than in Canada. There are very few, there are virtually no good legal precedents in Canada for human rights, whereas there's a whole developed body of law in the United States on this issue. So you have to look to the United States simply because there are no decisions in Canada. The classic, the landmark one in the United States involved Southern Bell Company in the United States, where the policy had always been that certain jobs were white jobs and certain jobs were black jobs. Then when the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64, they no longer could continue with that policy. So a new system immediately came into being that the jobs that previously had been white, that had no educational requirements attached to them, overnight required high school graduation. Now, the effect of that very obviously was to eliminate the vast majority of the black population from applying because they did not have the same numbers graduating from high school as did the white population. In the case that went to the courts, the evidence showed that having high school graduation in no way could be justified as being necessary for performing that job. It was not a bona fide requirement to do that job, and therefore, although it maybe was not intended to discriminate, its impact was to discriminate, and it was illegal. And since that time in the United States, any tests of any kind, any criteria relating to jobs that have an adverse effect on minority groups must demonstrate through research, through evidence, through statistical testing, that they are valid. They must prove that they are valid and that they do relate to job ability. Otherwise, those tests, those criteria are illegal and discriminatory. So this was one of the landmark cases, and I think this situation is very relevant here in this province where many jobs require high school graduation, which means that if it's in an area where there are many Native people, where there are people from economically deprived backgrounds, they can't apply for those jobs. And yet, in fact, is it necessary to have high school graduation to effectively do those jobs, or is it a hypocritical form or an unintentional form of discrimination? Another example that you might take would be the fact of having height requirements. Having height requirements, for example, to be a police officer or to be a bus driver, which, whether it intends to or not, discriminates against different racial groups, against Oriental people, and discriminates against women. If we look at another aspect, move on to another level of what is discrimination, what form does it take, we have to recognize the fact that it takes two to discriminate. In other words, the minority person must challenge the barriers. If the minority person or woman accepts their traditional role, doesn't try to break through the barriers, then you have no incident of discrimination. And I think in this area, we must consider the power of brainwashing and conditioning on these groups of people. We must consider how difficult it is to break out of the stereotype role. The pressure to conform is extremely strong. Studies that Dr. Jack Kehoe of the Education Department here was mentioning recently showed that where they tried to set up situations where a Native Indian person would take a dominant role towards a white person was extremely difficult, in that the whole tradition and pressure and expectations led the white person to naturally assume the dominant role, and they set up testing situations where the Native Indian would be pre-instructed in some area that they would in turn have to instruct to the white person, in the hope that this would achieve a reversal of the normal relationships. And it was found that it was exceedingly difficult to break through that traditional relationship of dominant role for the white person. I think this is the same reason, the same situation applies when we find that women's groups want to have consciousness-raising groups on their own, simply as realizing this is the only way that they can make steps to breaking out of that traditional pattern of the dominant male and the subservient female. I think we have to recognize that the pressure to live up to the stereotype is extremely strong, that we find that people will jeopardize their own health, their own welfare, their own well-being to fit the stereotype. We see this as being true in the past when we look and we wonder how could it possibly have been so that women 100 years ago, because of the pressure that they should have the form of an hourglass and that the man's hand should pass around their waists, would torture their abdomens, do heaven knows what to their intestines, cause themselves great physical suffering and great damage to their health in trying to fulfill this artificial pattern that was then the norm for female acceptance and attractiveness. In the same way that we know that in China in the past, the tradition was to bind girls' feet so that they would suffer through agony in order to fit that stereotype. And we can laugh and we can be amazed and say how terrible that people can be so mutilated and so much prisoners of the stereotype and the pressure to conform. But what about the situation we have right now today in our society, where we hear that there are thousands of women who have injected hormones into their breasts in order to fulfill that beautiful image of what it is to be a sexually attractive female, and that thousands of women in the United States and across Canada are suffering sickness, gangrene, and death because of that? And how can we say that the pressure to conform to the stereotype is not strong today? It's so powerful that people will mutilate themselves physically and mentally to conform to the conditioning. I think another factor that we need to look to, in addition to the conditioning and brainwashing, is the fact that whether models exist for minority groups and women in order that they can attempt to achieve equal opportunity. If there are no models, how can that possibility even exist in the mind of the young person, of the child and the adult? I know that when I think back to my own childhood, coming from a working class area of London, where there was no conceivable idea that girls could go to university, and the fact that ever I did was due to just a total fluke of chance and circumstance, and that the idea of going there was almost inconceivable in my mind, that the idea of the possibility of going to a university was just something that was almost unthinkable. And the fact that I did go was largely just through a series of accidental circumstances. But even then, I ended up in the French department taking an arts degree. And there was no way that I could go further beyond the conditioning, which I'd already pushed to the extreme to even get there. There was no way that I could possibly have conceived, or any of the other young people in my situation have conceived, of going into areas like science or economics or law or medicine. Would have been totally impossible to even conceive of. There were no models. That possibility did not exist in the minds of the young people. And I think the whole role of expectations is extremely important. We've heard so much that biology is destiny, and to my mind, it's expectations that are destiny. And we see that minority young people and girls have extremely limited expectations out of life, that their thoughts and their hopes and their expectations have been severely limited. I think we have to consider also the feelings of self-respect and self-worth that minority people and women have. And I think these feelings have been damaged by our society, and that they do not have the same confidence in themselves, the same respect, the same conception of their ability. It's interesting that when these stereotypes are broken, what the reaction is of the general public. It's often quite a hostile reaction when the groups that traditionally have been somewhat docile, somewhat taking willingly a position of inferiority, when they become assertive. And an interesting case was the one that I mentioned to you, where the Native Indian group attempted to rent a car to go to a sports event. And when they were refused, they were quite outspoken in their anger of this refusal. And when we spoke to the manager of the rental agency on the phone, he was quite outraged at this and said, well, their attitude clearly showed that they were not fit people. The fact that they would show anger at this, to his mind, totally condemned them, because he did not expect anger to come from a group such as this. The same thing was true when we had a case in Victoria where a woman applied to be a bus driver. And then, regardless of the fact that she had excellent, outstanding qualifications and record and experience exactly as a bus driver, in the interview the questioning centered on her marital status and her relationship to a man. And when she refused to answer these questions as to what her marital status was, then the reaction of the interviewer was extremely angry and refused to consider her application for the job, and thought that this obviously showed that she was aggressive and unpleasant and unfit to do the job. And we find very often that when minority group people and women stand up for their rights, they are labeled as aggressive, unpleasant, and unworthy. I think we see the same reaction taking place when we see that visible minorities, racial groups who have immigrated to Canada, start applying for the non-traditional jobs. As long as they stick to the jobs that traditionally have been filled by racial minorities, it's fine, the jobs that nobody else wants. When they start applying for the better jobs and the overtime and the better housing, then we get the reaction. These racial groups coming into Canada are taking our jobs, and they've got no right to. As long as they stick in the jobs and the positions where we allow them to be, that's fine. But once they start competing as equals, then the reaction often is quite hostile. I think we cannot underestimate the pressure of public opinion against anyone who challenges these traditional stereotypes. Why do you think it is that almost every woman who attains any prominence or public exposure feels called upon to deny immediately any belief in women's lib? Yes, she believes in equal pay. Yes, she believes in equal opportunity. Yes, she believes in economic partnership and the rights of the woman in marriage. But no, she doesn't believe in women's lib, she hastens to assure everybody. What else is women's lib but those very things? How else would some steps be made towards obtaining those rights, and there's a very long way to go yet before they are obtained, if it wasn't for women's lib? And the familiar response is to drag out the old lunatic fringe bogeyman. And yet I could point out that there are some groups that are part of the Canadian democratic scene who run candidates for election and have as a platform banning colored immigration into Canada, sending home anyone of a racial minority, outlawing mixed marriages. These groups exist in the Canadian political scene, but because of them, we don't reject and vilify the whole democratic system because of that fringe element. And yet that is the kind of reaction that is taken in trying to vilify or derogate women's lib, as it is called. So I think when we look at all these factors and we try to define what discrimination is, we have to realize and admit the fact that discrimination may never take place simply because the discrimination has been so entrenched and so strong that the minority groups and the women accept their second-rate position in society. Thus, our definition of discrimination under human rights laws is perhaps somewhat superficial if we say discrimination is when there is differential treatment. If those groups never apply, never come forward and challenge, well, then there never is any need to differentiate in treatment because all the applicants, all the people who come, will be the white male dominant group. And I think this is one of the weaknesses of human rights legislation in Canada, is that the onus, the burden, is on the individual who suffered from discrimination to initiate action. And I think the aspect of this problem that often goes unrecognized is that those groups that have historically suffered discrimination are affected by discrimination in their attitudes towards themselves. On the one hand, their belief in their own ability, potential, and worth has been damaged. And on the other hand, experience has taught them to expect less favorable treatment from others. Yet we place the full burden of achieving equal opportunity on the shoulders of those who have always been denied it. Not only must they maintain full, undamaged confidence in their own equal ability, but they must also be prepared to assert themselves in the face of anticipated rejection. The human rights legislation, in addition to just waiting until the individual brings forward a complaint, deals only with the individual incident of discrimination. Human rights legislation in Canada is geared to the isolated episodes of discrimination, but discrimination is not episodic and it is not isolated. Discrimination against Native Indians, ethnic minorities, and women is ongoing, entrenched, and pervasive. It does not only take the form of blatant, deliberate rejection, but also thrives on subconscious expectations and attitudes and on routine, unquestioned practices and policies that are not recognized as discriminatory. If we succeed only in tackling the odd, isolated incidences one by one and do not fundamentally change the overall pattern, whereby groups are routinely and systematically thwarted of fair opportunity, what have we really accomplished? And I think the remark made by Sonia Fuentes in appearing before a hearing in England on discrimination is very relevant. She said that in the United States, we have found that the processing of individual complaints, even where they are brought to successful fruition through the execution of conciliation agreements, do not significantly alter discriminatory patterns and practices in the company involved, the industry, or the country. Discrimination is by and large systematic, institutionalized, woven into the entire fabric of a company's personnel practices. Unless the underlying systems are attacked and radically altered, significant change does not occur. Justice for a few individuals, while necessary and important, does not alter the broad pattern. And I think this is a very serious issue that we must consider when we look at the effectiveness of our human rights legislation in Canada. Discrimination is also dealt with under our laws after the event. It is tackled after discrimination has already occurred. And this approach, to my mind, is an extremely negative one. It is based on the premise that the absence of discrimination is sufficient. All that is required under the mandate of human rights legislation is that those with power to hire, rent, or provide services refrain from active discrimination. Is this a token mandate? Kalman Kaplansky has stated that we are only now beginning to realize on this continent that what is required is not merely the absence of discrimination, but the presence of positive programs to help economically disadvantaged minorities. In other words, in a society of entrenched and long-standing racial and sexual inequality, equal opportunity may mean, in fact, differential treatment. In a society of color and sex discrimination, we cannot be color or sex blind. To quote Justice Berger, the underlying premise of affirmative action is that unless positive action is taken to overcome the effects of systematic, institutionalized forms of exclusion, then the status quo will be perpetuated indefinitely. A policy of benign indifference means indefinite continuation of discrimination. The flow of opportunities is like a river, and we know who gets watered. It follows its well-worn track with unimpeded assurance, and those groups who traditionally have been kept out of the mainstream of influence, power, and privilege get bypassed, ignored. With all respect, as lawyers say when they have no respect, this describes quite aptly, I think, the records of governments, universities, and professions who have benignly ignored the fact that minority groups and women have not had fair participation in their area of activity and have not had their needs fairly dealt with. I think the fallacy that benign indifference is an adequate response to discrimination is well illustrated in the field of education. Here, if anywhere, one would believe discrimination and prejudice could not thrive in an environment dedicated to the pursuit of knowledge, truth, and justice. Yet on a closer look in studies across Canada, we find that minority groups and women have not been given fair or proper treatment in school textbooks or school courses. They have, for the most part, been ignored as unworthy of interest or briefly referred to in passing in patronizing or derogatory terms. In the classroom situation, it has been found that teachers hold lower expectations and give different counseling to minority students and girls than they do for the white male student. In the crucial area of education, experience has shown how a neutral, passive policy towards the existence of discrimination has allowed prejudices to thrive in ignorance unabated. Indeed, it has actually reinforced them. So what we are saying from these points is that affirmative action is necessary until equal opportunity has been achieved. It means that there is a need for special measures to open up the doors to minority groups and women. There is a need to energetically seek out and encourage competent people from minority groups, either to apply for jobs, enroll at colleges or universities, or to take apprenticeship programs. There should be efforts to make known through minority organizations that opportunities exist. There should be efforts to create an environment that welcomes and is receptive to them. This may be training personnel managers and supervisors in awareness and sensitivity towards minority groups, in recognizing and rooting out prejudice. It means also setting goals and targets and monitoring them to see that, in fact, the system does change. From the point of view of the university, I think the university should sell itself to minority groups, particularly where they are underrepresented. I think this might mean a special recruitment program to encourage and welcome and bring in students from minority groups. It may mean special courses responding to their particular needs, culture, and interests. It may mean special feeding in courses that will bring them up to the level of competence that's required. It may mean taking courses to the areas where minority groups are particularly found. I think the university owes this to social justice, and I think the university also owes it to its own commitment to what a university is all about, which is universality, breadth of vision, raising standards by expanding the area of knowledge and experience brought into the university. Reality is not only the white middle-class world. I think it is a fool's paradise if we exclude those values, needs, identities, experience, realities that minority groups and women can bring in with them. I think that having dealt with the issue of affirmative action, which means energetic, practical measures to bring minority groups and women up to the norms and feed them into the system, I think now the further, more serious aspect of discrimination deals with the whole question of exploitation of minority groups and women and deprivation that they suffer. Taking as an illustration a case in Ontario, which was an equal pay case, it was a situation where an employer had a number of women doing a job and one man. The man was getting paid more than the women. It was a clear equal pay case that could be proved. There was no difference at all in the work, and the man's rate of pay was higher. So this obviously could be dealt with under equal pay legislation. But the employer, in all innocence, explained at the hearing that, right, this might be so, but his plan was to move the man out of there, and then there would be no problem because all the women would be getting the same rate of pay, and then there would be no male there to compare them to. So then, hey presto, no discrimination in pay. And I think that while this is very comical in one sense, this is a definition of what is going on in society, in that we have minority groups and women segregated into a world apart where they have no rights. I think the equal pay legislation, and I think this issue does not only apply to women, it's exactly the same for minorities. It's easier to illustrate with women because there are more numbers of them in the workforce and you can show how that system happens. You no longer have a situation where women are allowed or encouraged to get into the same jobs as men. They are channeled off, siphoned off into special women's areas. And then the law is irrelevant. Human rights legislation is irrelevant because they are in a segregated ghetto. And what we are really saying in our legislation is, If you have got a white male there doing the same thing, then you've got a case. Then you're obviously doing something that's worthwhile. Then you're entitled to the higher pay, the higher salary, the higher status. But no man, no status. If you don't fit that white male image, you don't have a case, you don't have value, you don't have merit, you're obviously, and your salary check will show it, doing something, performing something that is inferior. And I think this is somewhat of a farce in the area of human rights, in that it completely eludes the whole principles of the legislation by neatly sidestepping the issue. We have the same reaction when we talk, if you talk to some employers, you're talking to a whole group of employers, and some will get up very proudly and say, we don't discriminate against racial minorities, we only hire racial minorities. And you'll find out that they are paying at the lowest wage that is going, with the lowest opportunities and fringe benefits and possibilities of promotion. And the same thing for women. Very proudly say, I don't discriminate against women, I only hire women. The same as cases we get where they say they're advertising for a woman and we get a complaint from a man, this is discrimination, and we go to find them, to talk to them, and they say, oh, this is no discrimination. All we mean is this is a low-paying job and no man in his right mind would want this job. And they're right. When the man finds out what the salary is, he's no longer interested in that job. That's what the women's job means. That's what they are saying when they're putting on it, that they want women for this job. Or else they mean that it is low in status, it has a subservient ring about it, aura about it, whether it is a waitress or a clerical help, and therefore because it is considered subservient in status, it is therefore per se defined as a woman's job, and any man doing it would be considered to have lowered himself. How can we deal with this issue under human rights? How can we pretend that we have effective human rights legislation when we have a society that is segregated and ghettoized, where minority groups and women are separated and in that situation have no rights? I think what we're talking about here is exploitation by our society of racial minorities and women. I think our society is subsidized to the tune of many millions of dollars by the work of women and racial minorities. And if men were doing those jobs, if white people were doing those jobs, they would be getting an entirely different rate of pay, and society would be paying quite a different cost for those kinds of work. Whether we look at the situation of people doing farm work, being done only by colored people, whether we look at the service industry or clerical work. And I think an interesting point here to be looked at is the fact that minority group people and women, for the most part, are the least unionized in Canada. And we speak a great deal today of the great dangers and problems and disasters of unionization, of bargaining, of strikes, of the whole terrible problems that this presents in our society. But who is speaking about the problems of those who are not organized and the exploitation that they are enjoying and the fact that they are having to try and subsist in a time of inflation on minimum wage and the lack of protection that they have in being fired from their jobs and the lack of rights and the lack of fringe benefits that they enjoy? Whether we look at the situation of farm workers, whether we look at the situation in Canada where we have a great market for importing colored women as domestic servants who after doing a month's work may be ending up with $110 for a month's full-time work. These are the issues that we quietly ignore, that we do not speak of. And it is a serious, entrenched fight and issue that is going on here. It's interesting to note that some of the most strenuous and long-lasting and unpleasant of strikes that have happened in British Columbia, at least in Victoria, where I particularly would be more aware of what's going on, have involved women. One was in the hospital industry in a private nursing home, a strike that went on for 2 years, where the women were being paid at the minimum wage that were mostly, or for a large part, this industry involves colored women, where they were asking for a matter of a few cents an hour more, and where the response was that it would be preferable to close down the hospital than to allow unionization. The same thing was true recently with a restaurant in Victoria employing women, where the media covered the issue saying these greedy girls have forced this restaurant to close down, which it did do, when they were asking for a few cents, 20 cents, something like that, an hour more. Now, when we look at that in the scene of economic rights and employment protections for the workforce, what is going on here? Do we have exploitation of women and minorities? Which means that it is virtually impossible for them to unionize and organize and to obtain their rights. Is this an injustice? Is this something we should be concerned about, beside the abuses that we speak of from the union side? Should we also look at the abuses against minority groups and women whose rights in employment are not being protected? An article by Professor Hucker on securing human rights in Canada makes this point. It is axiomatic that formal enumeration of human rights is one facet and is meaningless if there is not the material basis for securing those rights. If minority groups do not have the material wherewithal, they are just as effectively denied human rights. The means of denial is incidental. So that if we have a situation where minority groups suffer such severe material deprivation, it is irrelevant to speak of equal opportunity in housing and employment when they do not have the means to even get into the job market, to get the training, to get decent housing, where they don't have the money to go to a motel or a hotel for a dinner. So those rights really are pretty meaningless in that situation. And I think this is a question we have to look at when we look at the situation of Native Indian people in this province. When we look at whether they do enjoy the basic necessities of life, such as food, housing, the opportunity for employment and health. When we look at the situation of prenatal care, which surely determines your whole right to have prenatal care, to have good diet and hygiene, what rights do they really enjoy? Are they condemned before they are even born? And the quotation that Beaumarchais made when he has the servant Figaro saying to the Count, for the difference in their status in life, all you had to do was give yourself the trouble to be born. And all these privileges are yours accordingly. Do we have a reverse situation where we can say for Native Indian children, all you have to do is give yourself the trouble to be born and you will suffer this deprivation, this denial of rights? And I think if we look at the facts, the objective studies and statistics show that we do in Canada have a kind of apartheid in reality, if not in law. If we see what are the opportunities, what are the privileges that are accorded to minority groups and those accorded to the dominant society. If we look at the numbers of Native Indian people in prisons in Canada, does this mean equal treatment under the law? If we look in the educational system, the numbers of Native Indian children who graduate from high school and university, do we have equal opportunity in education? I'm not talking about the law. We don't have a law that prevents them from going to the school or university, but in fact, in effect, is that what our system does? If we look at the numbers of Native Indian people on unemployment, do they have equal rights to jobs? How much freedom of choice can we say that racial minorities really enjoy? How much real opportunity do they have to develop their life according to individual ability and choice? Or is it predicted before their birth? Are the sins of the father visited from generation to generation? An article recently by John Porter was very interesting in pointing out that there really has been no change in Canada in the past decade in opening up economic opportunities and status to minority groups, that we do not have upward mobility in Canada, that your position in society, the benefits, the economic status that you will have is tied in and can be predicted by the racial and ethnic group you belong to. And you start at the top with a white Anglo-Saxon, and then you go to the racial groups that most resemble them, which will be the Germans and the Danes and the Scandinavians. And then you go to the Southern Europeans, you go to the Italians and the Greeks, and then you go down, you go to the French Canadians, and then you go down, and you go to the Blacks and the Native Indians and the Métis. And that will be your status in life defined by your racial and ethnic minority. His question that he raises is that, is the program that the government of Canada are adopting towards encouraging multiculturalism, is this in effect a means of perpetuating social inequality, racial apartheid? And the point of view that he is putting forward is that there should not be these programs towards encouraging different ethnic cultures to survive. I think the point that he makes is very real, and I don't think that I can possibly agree with his solution. Are we going to say that the solution must be the integration of Native people into our society, that it means the end of French Canada, that all ethnic groups must be thrown into the melting pot, that we must annihilate everything that is different in order to achieve social equality? In the same way, are we going to say that women must give up having children if they want to achieve in their careers the same as men? Are we going to say there must be total conformity to the white male model to have any fair chance of success? And my answer to that would be no. I think that if there is this severe deprivation, that if basic human needs are not met, then equal opportunity is impossible. I think that there must be economic independence, basic material necessities, and self-sufficiency. These things must be within the reach of all groups, or those groups have no human rights. The United Nations Charter of Children's Rights says that children are entitled to food, shelter, health, education, security. How far have we moved in Canada to achieving those rights for children of racial minorities, for children where women are the head of the household, for people who are born with a physical handicap? So I think we've looked at three different levels of the issue of discrimination. We've looked at differential treatment, the need for affirmative action to bring women and minorities up to the same standards, and we've looked at the basic segregation in society where groups are exploited and suffer real deprivation. And I think the question is, how does this kind of segregation get built up? How does it perpetuate itself? How is this white monopoly preserved? I think what we see is that there is a bending over backwards to facilitate and recognize potential merit in those who most closely resemble the traditional privileged incumbent. We recognize as having potential merit a person who has potential of fitting the image of the present elites. Merit, to a large extent, is in the eye of the beholder. And I think we see this in recruiting for jobs, in the kind of language and pictures and means that are used that bring in the people who most resemble the traditional incumbents. I think that even when there is recognition that a minority person or a woman is a good employee, there is still great pressure of social prejudice to prevent them from getting the opportunity. An example, last week in speaking to a personnel officer from a very large Canadian company who didn't understand too well exactly what my job was, or I'm sure he would have never gone on and told me this following incident that he was involved with, which was that they had a very good employee who was a black employee, and the question was whether they should give him this promotion, which he clearly deserved. And the issue was that he would then have to go to a training program, and then part of his work would involve travel. And an important aspect of the work was the personal contacts, the visits to the homes, the going to the clubs. And how would he be welcomed? How would he be accepted in that area? And therefore, the ability to do the job was irrelevant. It was the social prejudice that came into play. And I think we see that racial minorities, that Jews, that women are still not particularly welcome and sometimes are outright excluded from clubs and organizations which are the center of power and influence. Some of these clubs are well patronized by people from the university and from government. Sometimes the membership is paid for them even. And I think it is unacceptable that that universities should show benign indifference to this issue, that they should wait until some intrepid minority person or woman challenges this exclusion. Why not adopt a public policy of refusing to patronize any organization or club or facility until it becomes non-discriminatory? In terms of racial exclusion, I think this is an important factor to eliminate racial minorities. In terms of the exclusion of women, I think an important factor is the role of the wife. And I think that just as in past societies, there needed to be servants in order to allow a person to function in proper circles, today it is necessary to have a wife. It's the sine qua non in order to exist and to succeed. I think opportunity in our society is based on the premise that the ideal standard person has behind him or under him a lesser being who will relieve him of chores, menial tasks, domestic routine, raise his children. In other eras, servants performed these tasks. In colonial societies, natives took on these tasks. Today it is the wife. And I think Galbraith, in his book Economics and the Public Purpose, makes an interesting point when he says the conversion of women into a crypto-servant class was an economic accomplishment of the first importance. Meanly employed servants were available only to a minority of the pre-industrial population. The servant wife is available democratically to almost the entire present male population. Were the workers so employed, subject to pecuniary compensation, they would be by far the largest single category in the labor force. The value of the services of housewives has been calculated somewhat impressionistically at roughly 1/4 of total gross national product. The average housewife has been estimated at 1970 wage rates for equivalent employments to do about $257 worth of work a week, or some $13,364 a year. Employment opportunities are structured around this standard ideal person who will not let his family interfere with his work or education. He will pick up and go, and his attendants will follow without putting up any conflicting needs or wishes of their own. In the same way, the university structure has been traditionally set up for straight, uninterrupted, full-time, 8-year course of study. And this is not the usual life pattern of a woman. The rigid structure has been set up so that it is an either-or proposition for women, either personal ambitions and development and career or family, but not so for men. We must, I believe, if we are to have equal opportunity, recognize the whole person. Having a family is a part of most people's lifestyle. The workforce, educational system, and social structures must recognize this, accept this, and accommodate to this. We cannot set up a system whereby to succeed, a person must have a wife to take total responsibility for this area of life. Motherhood must not be regarded as a crime or a betrayal. Parenthood must be accepted as a normal part of life. And there are many practical ways I could go into, but there isn't time, as to how the structures of society could be changed in order to allow this. And as Galbraith says, this would be one element in ending the present monopoly of the better jobs in the technostructure by males. The disadvantages that we have by having this monopoly of a white male elite not only affects the excluded groups, but it affects society as a whole. It is not an efficient or effective way in terms of social good. What it means is we cut off the human dimension. There is an artificial, distorted basis on which decisions are made and priorities are set. A wealth of knowledge and experience is cut off and ignored, and wrong, harmful, and stupid decisions are made. Decisions on what kind of city to make, build, what kind of economic development to promote, what welfare, what prison institution, what educational setup to build. Again and again, we see that the wrong decisions are made because of all the scientific, technological knowledge is there, but the human awareness, the breadth of human knowledge and input, the personal awareness is not present. Our world is being run more and more by experts who are cut off from a personal knowledge of the problem. The clients and those affected are not represented and have no input. The decision is made by an artificial and isolated elite. And the examples of that kind of problem, I think, is where you see solutions for the problem of housing for welfare people, where the solution is made by people who have never been on welfare and have no personal awareness of the problems and decide that the solution is to build a huge monument in which they will shut up all the people on welfare. This is what happened in Montreal, where a huge apartment building was set up for welfare people and proved to be an absolute disaster in terms of meeting the needs. I think the disadvantage of this kind of monopoly results in a ghettoized society. A comment made by someone visiting Canada from Asia was that he at first thought in walking the streets that the problems of handicapped people, of disadvantaged people, people with mental and physical problems were dealt with in Canada because he saw no evidence of them on the streets as he walked around, and that maybe some fantastic solution of this masterful, wonderful nation had been found to deal with this. And then eventually he found out that what happened was that all these groups were locked up in institutions, were shut away from public view. And this is very much the kind of solution that is given to those problems. Looking towards the solutions, the question is, are we looking at the problems from the right aspect, from the right end? Is the problem with the physically handicapped who give up hope, who have psychological problems? Or is the problem with the school system that doesn't guarantee physical access to the schools? Is the problem with the native child who doesn't do well at school and drops out? Is that where the problem is? Or is the problem with the school system that is completely ignorant and ill-adapted to his needs and identity? Is the problem with the girl who has no career ambitions and no thoughts for her life except to fill in a few years as a secretary and then marry and have her 2.3 children, and then finds that she has 30 or 40 years of life filled with boredom and ends up popping drugs or hooked on a TV serial, or who ends up being one of the thousands of families that are single parent mothers in Canada and finds that there is no means of economic survival and the only option for her is to go on welfare. Is it her fault that this failure took place? Or is it the fault of the school system? Does the school have responsibility to open up choices and career options to her? Does the school system service discrimination, accommodate itself to discrimination, oil the works, lay out the red carpet? Or does it make a strong effort to counteract it? It's much more comfortable in life laying out red carpets, but perhaps the school system and the college system is too comfortable. I think the university is the key. The university is the crossroads in society and surely should be part of the solution. I think universities should represent the counterculture of a society. The truth of tomorrow is the heresy of today, and that heresy should be being developed in the universities. They should be exposing the problems, spotlighting with information and knowledge the evils and injustice and discrimination that our society prefers to ignore. And I think we must ask two questions. Does the university answer the traditional needs of the established power groups and enter into innovations as a fringe item? In the same way that sometimes you'll find that a union going in to negotiate hopes to get equal pay for the women workers, but if it gets to an either-or situation and their other benefits are in doubt, you know which is the first issue that gets thrown overboard. Is this the situation for universities, that innovating to meet the needs of deprived groups is a fringe item, or is it a priority, a serious priority? And the second question is, does the university react after minority groups and women themselves have fought to raise the issue and bring pressure to bear? Or does the university take a leading role in exposing the issues as a pioneer of truth, justice, and wisdom? Thank you.
Are there any questions? Ms. Ruff would be very happy to answer any that you may have to ask. Yes, Mr. Freeman.
What would our speaker say should be a wise immigration policy? Should we avoid augmenting the discriminatory problems by adopting a discriminatory immigration policy?
The question was, what should our immigration policy be? Should we try and avoid the problems of discrimination in Canada by adopting a discriminatory immigration policy? And I think the answer to that is quite definitely and clearly no, we should not do any such thing. I think what we must be clear in the discussion of immigration that will be going on and has started is to make sure that we do in fact separate the two issues of immigration and racism. And I think there has been too much a pretense to be discussing immigration when in fact what is happening is that racial overtones and pressures and values are coming into play.
Yes.
Is the loss of livelihood arbitrarily on reaching a certain age discrimination? Human rights legislation, as perhaps you know and are referring to, deals with the age up to 65 in employment and says that after 65, if the policy of a company is to retire people, this is not discrimination. I think we get into the whole issue of what employment is and how the opportunities are distributed in society. I would say that right now the priority is to make sure that within the ages that we have, up to 65, that there is a fair distribution of opportunities. Whether after that age we can make a situation where people would have the right to stay employed and protect it by law will be a new issue and a new move forward. I think obviously there's no reason why people should be made to retire at the age of 65 if they're happy and wish to continue in employment. I think the sad thing is that people often are under a necessity of continuing to work because of inflation and the effect that this has on pension plans and the kind of income that is allowed under pension plans. Have I ever been asked by males in what way they can help deal with discrimination against women? Have any suggestions or help been offered in along those lines? Usually there's a very great defensiveness on the area of discrimination. People feel very uncomfortable. This is why I think is a definite drawback in the kind of legislation we have in Canada, which no matter how you try and get around it, is very much an adversary system where you have to have a complaint, someone who makes an allegation of discrimination, and someone whom the allegation is made against. Our role under the legislation is to try and get a fair settlement. And even then, I think that's an interesting issue because most of the cases, particularly if there's good evidence, obviously we get a settlement because we can show that it is true. And you get the settlement, and that's a private matter. No one knows about it. Nobody hears about it. But also you have the fact, you have the overriding public interest, surely, that society as a whole needs to be informed of the kinds of discrimination that goes on and the fact that change has been made to occur. And the role of human rights legislation in Canada, I think, has been traditionally very secret, very quiet diplomacy, stress. And obviously this has advantages and you're trying to educate and persuade and conciliate. But in the terms of public awareness, I sometimes wonder, you know, how effective this really is being. I think also the fact that we only act when there is an allegation, whereas a different kind of legislation might be, instead of trying to find, wait until you've got a victim and try and prove that someone committed discrimination, instead of that approach, if you said, right, you just have to use the evidence of your eyes or the statistics to see discrimination is entrenched in our society. We require everyone who has power and influence, decision-making ability over hiring, recruiting, university enrollment, or whatever, we require you to take strong, practical, measurable efforts to open up to those groups in an effective way, and we will monitor to make sure you're doing that. And if you don't do that, then you will be contravening the law. And so that instead of trying to blame people and wait until you've got a victim, we're saying we all inherited this society. The least that we can do is make genuine efforts to change it. And unfortunately, the point you're implying is very true. It is virtually never, it is extremely rare, I could maybe think of three incidences where someone with some influence has had an obvious wish to try and help, to try and change. And the usual reaction is that whenever you go to a group who have power, you speak of discrimination. If you speak in an abstract way, if you speak about another country, if you speak about another generation, fine. If you speak about their doorstep, there is immediate defensiveness, hostility, resentment, and it is extremely difficult to achieve anything substantial. And what I wonder is this quiet diplomacy across Canada in human rights. How many human rights cases have you heard of? How many legal decisions do you know of in Canada? There's virtual ignorance These, even the ones that go to open boards of inquiries, there's no publicity, there's no means of spreading that information to the public across Canada. We don't know. We know all the cases that go on in the United States, but in Canada we just haven't developed this area. We haven't taken it seriously. We haven't made it public. I don't think we have done a proper job. And so the quiet diplomacy goes on. The individual's complaint is put right. Does it happen to the next person who comes along? If it does, are they going to have the guts and the unpleasantness to file a complaint? Because it takes guts and unpleasantness to file a complaint against an employer or a landlord. It's not a pleasant way of spending your time. And the question that comes to me quite often is, you know, it's fine to try and settle and quietly deal with individual complaints, but is this a hoax? Is this just pandering to the comfort of the conscience of the majority without requiring them to make any substantial change whatsoever? And I think this is a serious issue.
Yes,
definitely. I'm a little distressed. All minority groups, all and over the period of the last 4 years, there are minority groups in Canada who were once very markedly discriminated against, but that particular minority group is no longer discriminated against in the same way. There have been considerable advances. The legislation isn't all marked human rights legislation, but there's a lot of legislation to remove hindrances to human rights. And yet, I get the feeling that you're simplifying the issue by these large generalizations and grabbing all up in one thing. I'm aware of one of the things that concerns me. You've been mostly concerned with economic discrimination. I agree this is a very vital concern. I was glad to see you disagree with John Porter on the subject of where social discrimination or cultural discrimination conflicts with economic discrimination. And you came down, as I understood, from the side of the against cultural discrimination, even in the interest discrimination, but that point itself, I'd like to hear you elaborate on a little more. Lastly, I myself am very concerned about this reference you made to private clubs. I think this is one of the areas that we really need to attack now very vigorously. And I'm wondering what your agency is doing about that. And may I throw in also churches which discriminate against women. What are you doing about that? I think, no, I'm very serious about this. I am very against, for example, at least a nominal anger. I'm outraged by the attitude displayed in this particular nominally Christian about the place of women. But private clubs and churches are very important areas of discrimination. And it seems to me that we have to be rather more selective and use a little more of our right approach rather than the shotgun approach of embracing everything. And I think your own stereotype, if I may say so,
I don't know how I can repeat that whole question. It's quite a number of issues that were raised there. I'll try and recall them one by one. The first one was the point that in speaking of discrimination against different minorities and women, this is an oversimplification and that this is a stereotype and that laws have been passed and groups have achieved fairly in Canada. Now, obviously, there isn't time in a talk like this to go into the particular situations and variations of different minority groups, I think the fact, nevertheless, is still fairly strong that particularly visible racial minorities do not enjoy equal status, equal opportunity in Canada. And I think that's the point that Porter is bringing out, and that's the point that I think almost any studies show to be in this stratified system that we have built up in Canada. And I think certainly the same is true for women, and that the studies of women as a group do show still very entrenched patterns of discrimination. And I don't think you can call this a stereotype. I think it's the overall picture. And obviously there are all kinds of different aspects that can be talked about, but nevertheless, I think the overall situation is true. The other points about the private clubs and the churches discriminating and how serious it is that these issues should be tackled. Well, one point is, as far as discrimination against women in private clubs, if a private club is created that has as its purpose a particular group, it is exempt from the legislation. So if you have a club that has in its charter, we exist for the purpose of advancing communication between males and only for male membership, there's no way that that could be dealt with under the legislation at all. In terms of racial discrimination or religious discrimination, again, we really are in a very difficult situation unless we get some kind of complaint or specific incident that we can follow up, although there, you know, that may happen and we would deal with them. As far as the churches go, I'm just going through my mind under what section of our code we might take action. I agree with you that this is obviously a very serious issue. It does affect our whole culture and our whole attitudes. And even though many people in Canada may not be practicing members of a religious faith, I think there is no doubt that the religious influence is extremely strong, and that the philosophy, the ethics, the moral belief, the spiritual belief that in God's eyes women are inferior to men and unacceptable is definitely something that has an impact on the attitudes that everyone in the whole of society then adopts and follows on from there. I think those were the main issues you raised.
Well, economic.
Oh, right, sorry, right.
You, I think, didn't make it exactly clear
right.
where you stood with
the right, support. Right. Well,
there, I remind you that the vertical mosaic is pretty old hat now.
Well, this is a more recent article that he's put out. It's not. I'm not referring to the vertical mosaic. It's a stand that dealing particularly with the point of view of the multiculturalism program of the federal government is what he's speaking about. And in his view, he's saying that this program is harmful. Now, I don't want to debate that issue in itself specifically, but the general point is, should there be encouragement and support for the existence of ethnic minorities in Canada? And his point is that encouragement of these different groups to exist means that they are segregated and kept out of the mainstream, and the price that they pay for being an ethnic minority that maintains its viability and culture means that they are denied economic equality and acceptance into the mainstream. And therefore, his conclusion seems to be that we should encourage the absorption of ethnic groups into the mainstream of Canadian society. And I agree with his problem that it's true that racial and ethnic minorities are excluded, but I don't think his solution is right. I don't think that the price to pay is acceptable or necessary. I think we have to fight for the same thing, that the equalizing of opportunity and the upward mobility, but that we must not demand that we annihilate all different racial and ethnic cultures. I don't think we should say that if Native Indian people want decent opportunity and standing of living, they have to integrate with white society. I don't think we have to say that French Canada must disappear if it wants to join in the economic benefits of Canadian life. No, I don't agree with that.
There's no questioner up there. Yes. I'm sorry, I recognize the gentleman up there. Oh, sorry.
I want to ask a question, but first of all, I want to say that I think this has been about the most refreshing and meaty talk I've ever heard at the Vancouver Institute. Breath of fresh air. I wanted to ask you, Mrs. Ruff, would you expand a little bit more as to what you think, what positive steps you think the university should be taking, for instance, this university, towards bringing racial minorities in? I was very pleased to hear that a year ago the Faculty of Education at UBC started a program for Native Indian Native Indians, to including ones who perhaps had not even finished high school, to get them into the Faculty of Education to train them as teachers. We've never had an Indian or an Eskimo medical student at UBC. As far as I know, there are no Indian physicians in the province. Would you want to expand on some positive things that we might be doing as a university to move ahead?
Right. Well, I think the question was that what positive things might the university do to bring in Native students, Eskimos, minority group students into the university, what kind of things might be done. And I think the example you used about a program in the education department which brought in Native Indian students who didn't necessarily have the graduation from high school that normally would be required, but that would feed them into the system nevertheless. And I think this is one very definite way that needs to be done, that recognizing the inequality that does exist, you set up a special feeding in program, which means you accept students regardless of the fact that they didn't follow the standard routes that most white students follow. And you say, if you have ability, if you have a potential, even if you left school at grade 6 and then went out and worked in the woods or did goodness knows what for so many years, but you've got interest, you've got potential, you've got motivation, we'll accept you as a student. We've got this special program to orient you and to feed you with what you lack so that you can feed in. There's one program that's been started, I think it's at the University of Saskatchewan, I think, for law, to bring Native students into law school. And what it does, it accepts students regardless of what their background is, and it gets them to apply for law schools. And if the law school will say, we'll accept you if you complete this special program, i.e., we think, yeah, you have merit, we think you've got potential, you don't have the standard qualifications to get into law school, but you've got, you know, a certain amount of ability that you can show, and we would give you a chance. Once they've been approved, in that way they feed into this course, which builds them up to the level so they can go into law school and has native tutors, like the students that have gone through the system before, come back and act as tutors to encourage them. That kind of thing, I think, is important. I think also what we need to look at is in different kinds of professions and jobs, particularly those jobs that service minority group people. For example, if you look at welfare, if you look at education where there is a large Indian community or ethnic group community, if you look at the prison system and you see what is the purpose of that profession or job, and surely it is to serve the needs of the clients. Well, why recognize academic criteria as being the sole and only a monolithic approach to do that job and be accepted in it? Surely, ability to understand, to be accepted, to communicate, to have some awareness of that group is also just as important a criterion that should be recognized. And this might mean starting up with a situation of paraprofessionals, like in the medical field, with the incredible problems that exist for Native children, for the need for prenatal care, which condemns Native kids before they're even born. This fantastic need. Well, surely we don't have to look for thousands of degrees and academic qualifications and professional hurdles, but to do that job that's needed, to accept that the key criteria is ability to relate and perform and achieve results. And then, accepting that criteria, give what's necessary. Maybe train paramedicals in that area and let them come in after a while and join the regular system. But we need more alternatives. There should not be, as long as we continue to have one monolithic structure and approach that is geared around the white, male, middle-class, urban person, we're not going to meet these other needs. And the qualifications that we create are not really adequate. They are not doing the job properly. You can have the most qualified person in the world going into the prison system, going in as a guidance counselor. But if they can't even communicate or understand or be acceptable to the inmates and really achieve what's required, do they have the qualifications? Are there other qualifications that are just as important and that should be recognized and be accepted? And the same, we could make the same point in our school system. And the very small example, like with a human rights officer, if our job was to relate to racial minorities, to give credibility to them, to give information to them, well, what on earth would a piece of paper, a degree, guarantee that you could do that job? And then you would exclude all those other people who had fantastic qualifications, who'd worked in that area, didn't have that little piece of paper, but they had other qualifications that were just as good. And I think until, you know, this snobbery goes, until this monolithic approach goes, we will not do the job properly in those areas. And we will deny opportunity for those groups that could do the job. But this will be difficult, I think. There'll be a lot of resistance.
Yes, I'll recognize it.
Would you care to comment on the discrimination that is practiced by trade unions? I'm referring to the total shop. If I want to go and work as a long time,
right. I've been asked about the practice of closed shop and discrimination by unions in requiring membership in a union in order to get certain jobs. No, I really would not comment on this except to say that this is a matter of labor legislation in Canada. You have your whole history of development in Canada of what are the rights to organize, what are the rights of the employer, what are the rights of fellow workers. You have the situation in Canada under our laws, under every province, where closed shops are a factor and a legal part of the system. And I think that is the issue there, and it is not a question that relates to the question of human rights at all. If you want to talk about human rights, about closed shop, if you want to point out or comment on the fact that minority groups are excluded or don't get welcomed in or somehow don't get membership in unions and that women don't get into unions and get into apprenticeships, fine. That I would comment on. That is a relevant human rights issue. But I do not recognize myself that the closed shop issue is a human rights issue. I think it's a straight legal, political, labor decision of Canadian history.
I think we'll take one more question. Yes.
Yes, you've spoken about affirmative action. I wonder if you could go into a little more detail about how this legislation works in the United States, about how it might affect an institution such as CBC, for example, in Canada. And if you have any indication that the bill introduced by Rotary Ground into the legislature in the last session will be reintroduced or is likely to be introduced by the government.
Right. I've been asked about how, in give more details as to how affirmative action legislation operates in the United States and whether the bill that Rosemary Brown put in on affirmative action will come back again for reading in the House. The affirmative action legislation in the United States requires that any employer or institution that receives funds, contracts, permits from government that shares in cost-sharing formulas must take affirmative action so that minority group people and women are fairly represented according to their existence in the community, in the most relevant, based on the relevant data of how many are qualified and how many exist in that community. They have to analyze the situation, see what the statistics show as far as the representation of minority groups and women, and also handicapped people physically. Handicapped people are also covered by the legislation. And then to show practical, deliberate, measurable plans, programs, with full-time people administering them, and with accountability so that they are monitored systematically to see what the statistics shows, what changes can be measured to have happened. If the changes have not taken place, they must give the reasons why those goals that were set as realistic goals were not achieved. If they have valid reasons for showing, we aimed at getting 20 Native Indian students into our program this year, but we only got 10 because of, and that's shown to be valid, and they did go all out, they did make a genuine effort, then there's no question, there's no problem. If they did say, well, our goal was to get 50 women into this senior position where previously there was one, and there were 300 openings that came place in the year, and they didn't achieve that goal, they show why, and they show what efforts they made. If they're genuine, they made valid efforts, no problem. So it is not saying quotas. It's not saying, come hell or high water, you must get that number of heads by a certain period of time. It says you must make good faith, genuine efforts. If they have not made the efforts and therefore have not achieved the goal,